Mr. Bright Realto.
Right. Well, I can't say it affected me as such, apart from realising there was anti-Semitism due to the newspapers, the speeches, knowing what the SS are, or the SSS were. You saw their uniforms, you saw them trotting about. You also saw a lot of uniforms on the street, army uniforms. That was quite obviously in preparation for war. It started in around about 1935 or something. We had a cardboard pig hung up in the kitchen, which had written on it, "I eat and I eat not." That meant we had to separate for recycling bits of food which could be used as pig's food. That was, in other words, the Germans tried to reduce imports on food and use whatever foreign currency they had on importing raw materials. I also remember, as a very young lad, partaking in an anti-aircraft, in an air raid, trying an air raid exercise. As I said, there was a large area between front and rear block, and we all assembled, and they started an incendiary bomb, and they showed us what to do with it. Namely, you throw a bucket of sand over it. They prepared for war, and they anticipated retaliatory action already then. And I also remember going on holiday to Marienbad and traveling during the night in a sleeper, and looking out of the window, I saw searchlights all the way from start right along the line, searchlights and planes, which they tried obviously to find and hold. And there must have been hundreds of searchlights, so again, they were extremely well prepared already then. I can't say it was 1935 or 36, but it wasn't much later. And once I went on holiday, I didn't think much of being an only child, and didn't think much of being sent by myself. But one of the employees in my father's firm, or where my father worked rather, had a small holding, lived in a small holding, on a small holding, near Berlin. And I went for holiday there once, and I called it Conkers, and we shot, I'm a Tony, so that was quite new, the country. And there were maneuvers, the German army had maneuvers. Now, I was just a little boy, I was about six or seven at the most, and the soldiers were very, very pleased to show me everything, how to take a rifle apart and put it together again. They showed me the Gulasch Kanone, which is the mobile kitchen, and they were actually full of it. They were full of awe. And I then told them that I was Czech, and they actually felt, I remember that, they felt to the floor, because they had taken me as one of their own, and now they realized they'd been talking to, not so much Jewish, as a Czech boy, whom they were quite prepared to attack in 3 years' time. So there were certainly impressions of war starting. And that, of course, made things worse for us, or for everybody else, for that matter, as it limited the time you could get out. Once war was more imminent, one would be attacked.
Was your family still in Berlin when the Munich crisis broke?
No. We were in Prague then. What happened was in May 1938, when things were getting terribly uncomfortable, and my father's firm would close, it was a Jewish bank, he left for Prague. Now, the Czech army had mobilization as a result, and he joined the army. That was rather uncomfortable for us. My mother and I stayed in a small pension run by nuns in Prague, just one room, just somewhere. And what happened then was that the Allies did not honor their agreement, as to say, the Allies, and as much as the Western Allies, Britain and France, didn't honor their agreement to defend the country. Although the Czech army was extremely good, they were a rather old-fashioned planes, just like the Poles. And but they did have a Maginot Line. Now, the Maginot Line ran along the Sudeten frontier. In fact, the frontier was picked because there was a mountain range, which was a natural advantage. Whoever had the heights had the advantage. The Sudeten had a line of hills, they had a Maginot Line. Well, that meant that if the Maginot Line went, the Republic would go. That was really, the Sudeten as such didn't matter. Once the Sudeten had gone, there was nothing to prevent anybody from walking in, which of course it eventually happened. So we were in Prague during the Munich crisis as such. And we were, although it wasn't theirs to give away, we were given away. And the Russians, of course, although very little mention was made of that later, did exactly the same. They said, because the Western Allies aren't going to protect you, we aren't going to help you either. But they had an agenda of their own, the Germans. They had a Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, and they were interested in the Czechs.
How did you personally like it in Czechoslovakia as compared with what you'd experienced in Berlin?
Well, not really. The simple reason, Prague was teeming with refugees. What happened was the Czech Republic was very, very liberal, very democratic, very tolerant. Every nationality, and they had many. They had the Carpathian and ethnic one end, they had the Slovaks, they had the Czech Moravians, they had the Austro Sudetans. Everybody had their rights as to language and custom, and they also opened their doors to refugees. Mind you, it was quite obviously not a solution as much as they could offer no employment. They had unemployment themselves. They had been hit by the 1927 crash as much as anybody else. There had been floods of absolutely penniless refugees from Germany at first, later from Austria. And the thing was, of course, it was safer to wait for a visa in Prague than it was in Berlin or Vienna, but it still wasn't the solution. And then came floods of refugees from the Sudeten after the takeover. And so it was full of rather unhappy people. So it wasn't a particularly happy time, no. Obviously, the Germans went there until March 39. It happened very closely. You see, May 38 and March 39 wasn't that long to go. And in March 39, on a very snowy day, the Germans marched in. They obviously didn't respect all the paper. Then it was said that the Sudeten was the last of his territorial ambitions. Obviously, it wasn't true.
Did you see the Germans marching?
Yes, I did. I remember exactly the spot where I was on my home from school. Because we had school either morning or afternoon, the school was a Jewish school. I couldn't attend a Czech school when I arrived because I couldn't speak Czech. It took me about 6 months to learn. So it was far better to go to a Jewish school, which in the end was much better in any case, because all the Jewish children from Czech schools were expelled too. And it was so full of refugee children and Czech Jewish children that they had to run to school morning or afternoon, and I was on my way home. And there they were riding on mainly on motorcycles, I remember, with a sidecar, and the light machine gun was mounted on the sidecar. And it was snowing very heavily. And they also had these Autobahn trucks, that's to say a truck with a trailer, which doubles its capacity. I don't know, you can see them sometimes here. It's got a large trailer behind. And they emptied the place like locusts. They would take anything, food, clothing, the lot, and after a few days there was nothing left. It was really pretty awful.
How did the Germans behave at first?
Well, they established their Gestapo headquarters in what had been a Jewish bank. They were busy at first looting, and then they would set about registering Jews. They wanted to register, and later they wanted to register their possessions. That's when the father comes in, actually. Well, there were gradually restrictions built up. There were deportations which started, I think, 1941. There were quite obviously a large number of restrictions. There was a curfew at 8, you had to be at home by 8. Areas were cleared of Jews. You didn't get clothing coupons, you had to wear a star, you couldn't walk through certain streets. The worst of all, in a way, was shopping, because your shopping was restricted between 3 and 4 in the afternoon. Well, in wartime, there was nothing left between 3 and 4 in the afternoon. We were fortunate in that respect. When my father got demobbed, we moved into a newly built block of flats. We just rented this one-bedroom flat. It was very small. We had very little of our furniture from Berlin. We bought one or two bits and pieces. We didn't need much in a small flat on the fifth floor of a six-story block. We were outside the town. It was really the very outskirts in a borough called Lieben, which was a working class district. And therefore we weren't clear. There were no other Jews to be cleared out of. We were the only ones there. The building, the block actually, because it had been empty, was more or less filled with refugees from the city. So that was all right. And also there was a grocer and a pub at the end of a very short road before our block started. Our block actually overlooked the farm. It was not far out. And he was cooperative. He would put things under the counter. Now, he took a certain risk, but not an awful lot, because there weren't many Jews. And he would also charge a bit more. So you could nip in, and you'd get something. Even out of hours, it became more difficult when you wore a star, since you were extremely conspicuous if you carried something. But it wasn't far to go, and it would have been far more difficult for people in town, where you just couldn't take such risks. So therefore, things that were off the ration were very, very few things, only vegetables, and not even potatoes, and were very hard to come by. And that's really what we lived on, since our rations were very small, and you would have needed rations to go to the restaurant, not that one could. And the same applied to the pub. My father liked his occasional beer. So I would nip into the back door of the pub. The publican, or his daughter or wife, would go to the saloon part, draw the pint or whatever it was, 200 or 400 jug. And I would pay him about the back again. There's only a few steps really to the flat. Now, in the flat, you had to be careful because there was much later, a German woman and her son, young son, living downstairs. A Jewish family from the Sudeten had lived there. They had been deported, and she moved in, presumably she had been bombed out of Germany. And so you had to nip past her, but then I nipped up the stairs. I was quite smart in nipping up the stairs. So these were the restrictions. I remember visiting friends one day, school friends who lived at the other end of town. That was miles, and because being rather stupid, we left too late. There were two of us. It was a boy who lived upstairs in a flat above him, because he was a year older. We left it late, and we started to run, and we couldn't run. We rushed to the based in sweat, simply because we wouldn't get home by 8 o'clock. Now, we had to walk a very, very long German army range. It was a firing range, really, artillery regiment. I'm quite sure none of the Germans who were anywhere near the fence would have noticed us, or would know that there was a curfew. Neither would any of the Czechs know there was a curfew. People didn't take any interest. They wouldn't know, but nevertheless, the terror was such that he rushed like mad, even though it was probably all right. You couldn't take the risk. Of course, our parents weren't the risk, and we worried. You probably ran until that late, maybe 20 minutes, but it was highly upsetting.
Which year would that have been, do you think?
Oh, it must have been 41, probably 41.
Just going back, have you any memories of when Chamberlain declared war on Germany, the reaction then?
Not really. We obviously knew very well about it because that was, the trap was shut. That was, you couldn't get out. Once the war started, the borders of Germany had become completely closed, so that was the end. You had to wait for what the Germans had in store for you. There may have been, there were children who had been sent to Britain before that, shortly before that, on the what's known as Kinder transport. Their parents hadn't been allowed to go, but they left. Well, that all came to an end. And we had a large map of France, thinking that that war would be take the same form as it had taken the First World War. That map wasn't much use. It was soon over the line. The French were soon on the line.
What at that time in those early years of the war did you think was going to happen in the end? Did you have any idea?
No, we didn't. We didn't. We knew things. Choices to be taken from your home and have to move to another, say, from a house to a room because the area was clear, it was bad enough. To have all these restrictions was bad. But we had no news. People were at first transported to the ghetto, what the Germans called Litzmannstadt, and I think it was Lodz, the Polish town of Lodz. And there was very little information came back. You didn't read a paper, and the papers wouldn't publish it. There was no communication. You didn't know. What happened, and was much later, in Theresienstadt, in the ghetto, that people who arrived at Auschwitz could send a card. Most strange. But on arrival, those who survived the first selection could write a card. And they had agreed to use a code. If Uncle Sam was right, it meant something obviously went through census. They had called, and therefore we knew it was absolutely awful, but we didn't know what. And one tends to be optimistic. Had we known, it was kept from us. Although we were terrorized, we weren't told of the final solution. Although my mother always said that Hitler would not allow her to survive. And to be quite honest, Hitler in his book Mein Kampf said he was going to eliminate the Jewish race. So we knew that, but how and when? And that in fact they would divert people from the war effort to do just that seemed a bit unbelievable. We didn't know, and up to a point, I should say, we didn't want to know. Had we known, we would have maybe taken evasive steps. It would have been very difficult, because you had to have an identity card. There were checks, there were people checking your identity cards. There were checks as well, but that hadn't been in Slovakia. And if you went to a village, well, unless they hid you, you couldn't, you were obvious. And then somebody would tell you, the chicks weren't all that interested. You see, the Chamberlain affair, the Munich crisis, had taken the backbone out of the chicks. They had been let down by the Western Allies, they'd been let down by the Russians, they'd been let down by everybody. They were cooperating up to a point. They really were, in as much as they went to work in Germany. The Germans wanted them. They did not have to wear the same sign like the Poles, namely Ostarbeiter, or East. They were accepted, they sent money home, and they worked for the German war effort, made some money on the black market. They were not too concerned. They were certainly not going to risk their lives for Jews, unlike the Dutch. But then the Dutch and the Danes had been invaded. the Czechs hadn't fought a war. They hadn't been allowed to fight a war. They would have been very happy to do so. They were fully prepared for it. But the rug had been pulled from under them.
Did you know of anybody who had been hidden by the Czechs?
No. That doesn't mean anything, the fact that we didn't know. I mean, obviously it was kept a secret. We wouldn't know, but to this day, I don't know of anybody. I haven't pursued the matter. I haven't researched it at all, but I wasn't concerned. But I know from what I experienced that nobody was really interested to do much for you. It wasn't worth the risk, after all. As an example, Heydrich was killed by a group sent from England, not by native Czechs. And the recrimination and where they killed the population, sent the children away, was a result. So nobody was terribly keen on that. And Lidice was actually chosen because some of their menfolk joined the RAF. I think that's why, I'm not sure. But the Germans were very good at things like that to make you think twice. But at the same time, they were nothing like the terror they meted out to Poles. Because the Czechs did not resist until the last, very last 2 minutes, when suddenly found resistance fighters all over the place, mainly communists, as I said, they were there because it was easy. There was really very little resistance, from what I know, as I made this Heydrich affair, when the Gestapo even came to see us, two men with their trobes and their raincoats, and asked me where had I been on that instant. Well, I mean, it's clear that this happens, and my mother never left the flat in all the years we were there. And I had a friend, courthouseman, who lived in very poor conditions with an uncle and an aunt. I know his father was in Barcelona. I don't know what happened to his mother. And he just disappeared, and rumor had it that he had been machine gunned, that people, Jews, had been picked up in revenge, although that obviously had nothing to do with it, and had been killed. That may have been true. I don't think there was much Czech resistance. They were doing quite well out of it. And of course, it meant that the Germans didn't have to have troops there. It was in their favor. The same in Slovakia. Slovakia declared independence in 1938 under a fascist priest, and they did their own Jew hunting. In fact, they paid the Germans to kill their Jews. Now, priests don't normally act on their own, so they must have had the blessing of the bishop. And he still revered that same priest in Slovakia. And I only have one distant relative, also named Richter, who lives in Vienna, who was saved by her mother throwing out of a train, just throwing a child out. And she was picked up and brought up after the war.
When that Gestapo visit took place, was that the first one you'd ever had by then?
Yes. My father had been called to the Gestapo once because my mother suffered from high blood pressure, and she had a doctor who called every so often. In those days, what he did was he took blood. He actually applied leeches to reduce blood. It was a crazy idea because remember, within a day it was all back again. But the idea was to reduce the amount of blood, and therefore the use blood pressure. Now, the doctor was married to a German Aryan. It was a mixed marriage. And she tried to be a film actress, a small part film actress, and she was. So therefore they kept an eye on her, knowing that she had a Jewish husband. Her husband traced him to us. and called my father and say, what's he doing? You know, is there any, I don't know, any connection between Aryans on, from her side and him? And I know he had to do 100 push-ups. But my father was very fit, so he managed it. But that was, you know, he could be called and he may never come back.
When the Gestapo came at the time of the Heydrich assassination, was that in, at night or during the day?
No, during the day. They just had a list of Jews and they visited everybody. Why they should think of Jews that had done it, I don't know, but they just tried.
What was their demeanor when they came?
Threatening. You know, they didn't have to say much. They had to show their lip, behind their lapel, they had their badge. Gestapo, they looked like a clones, you know, they had just the same way and they appeared the same way. But they didn't stay long, I mean, they just asked where have we been and that sort of thing.
So they didn't search the house?
No, there was nothing to search. Because, as I say, they weren't interested where we had been at the time of the assassination. There wasn't much there. I mean, when I say restrictions, we had to also hand in all... We had to hand in radios right early on so we couldn't listen to the BBC or listen to anybody. We then had to hand in musical instruments. Now, I had a small violin of three-quarter size. And admittedly, I couldn't play. I started to learn violin. I didn't pursue it. You had to hand that in. And you had to hand in all jewellery except for your wedding ring. So when nowadays they speak of the Swiss gold, that's part of it. Everybody did.
Can you tell me again what the reaction was to the news of the Heydrich assassination?
It was pretty awful because we knew they were going to take reprisals. It wasn't going to do us any good. Whatever happened, the Jews would always suffer in the end. And therefore, if a thing like that happened, it wouldn't do us any good. And we were apprehensive.
So nobody rejoiced?
Well, not really. For a simple reason, if it wasn't him, it would be somebody else. You didn't. Somebody else would take his place. It would be just as awful. Unless you could wipe out the whole of the Gestapo building, it wouldn't really matter.
So was there any anger towards the assassins?
Oh no, I mean, that wasn't, not at all, but there wasn't any rejoicing either. The sort of thing wouldn't do us any good, so from that point of view there wasn't any benefit. But any German SS who got killed, that was a plus.
How did this period come to an end in the early part of the war?
It came to an end gradually. It came to an end for those who were being deported. Gradually, people were, first they said they were deported to the ghetto of Wismannstadt, and later they were deported to the ghetto of Theresienstadt, which is an ancient forest city built by Maria Theresa. It has large barracks, it has some living quarters.